Well, thank you. And I'm really honored to be here with all of you. So thank you for having us. And I'm most honored to be able to interview you, Karen, because I know a lot about what we're going to talk about, but probably not everything. And it's just such a great opportunity to highlight you and your terrific success at Bridgewater. So so thank you for doing this. And I thought I might start out with just asking you to describe a little bit more the background that was presented in the introduction. And in particular, I've heard you say a couple different times that, you know, you would have never seen yourself being at Bridgewater or investing and where you are. And so from where you started to where you are today, what was the path and how did you get here?
First, thank you all so much for being here. Thank you to Claire for having me. And thank you, David, for interviewing. That is true. I never would have imagined myself doing this, of all things. If you would have caught me, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, and said this is where I would be, I never would have believed you. So I grew up in Israel and went to Princeton, which was an incredible intellectual journey, and I was kind of interested in everything, but I don't think I actually knew what a stock was until pretty far down my Princeton education. It just wasn't something that came up. It wasn't something I grew up around. It wasn't something I didn't know any people who invested in stocks. I definitely couldn't have explained to you what a bond was. And I knew I was really interested in the world and how things worked. And I had an incredible thesis advisor, Danny Kahneman, who wrote Thinking Fast and Slow. And he was really instrumental in basically saying, the only path you've ever seen and known is going to be a university professor. It's what my parents had done. And you should not just go run after that. He was very humble in saying that he got incredibly lucky having the success that he has had. And I should kind of look around and see what's in the world. And so I was looking around and seeing what was out there. But my honest thought was I'd probably work for a few years and still go back and, you know, go down the sort of academic path. And initially, I actually did what I think everybody at the time, if you didn't know what you were interested in, but you were interested in kind of how the world worked and everything, you looked at consulting. That seemed like kind of the natural thing to look at. And I did that for a summer, and it was fine. And I wasn't so excited about it. And then I came across Bridgewater almost randomly. Bridgewater was on campus at Princeton. And what spoke to me about the firm kind of from the first minute, I actually remember being at the like information session, which, you know, tend to be kind of corporate, kind of buttoned up events, was I said, well, these people, I don't know what exactly they do, but they seem really, really into it and really excited about it. And whatever they're doing, it didn't seem like they're trying to please some other client or person. It seemed like they were doing it for themselves. So I said, that seems like a firm I should go talk to. But I came to Bridgewater, and you know, one of the really incredible things I think Bridgewater does is the investment in the first year. All new investment people basically get 1 year of class. I basically couldn't believe I was being paid to sit and take class. I mean, it was sort of like I came out of this incredible intellectual journey coming from a more, you know, rigid high school to Princeton where I could kind of learn everything. And I thought if I could go through one half of that intellectual journey again, that would have been worth it. And in your first year, you really sit and learn learn the basics. There's no assumptions that you know anything going in. And I think it was actually helpful for me that I didn't come into it with my life dream being investing, because I was really taking it as it comes and just wanting to see what I sat, like see what's coming at me and get excited. And I just got more and more excited about the content through the years. And to me, investing, while I never would have been able to say I want to be an investor, it brought together so much of what I was already passionate about. It was a really practical application of kind of how the world really worked, how economies really worked, what really mattered, and kind of changing the face of society and the world. And it felt like it filled a hole of things that I had thought I'd learned about. I felt like I didn't understand them at all without really understanding the financial aspect. So I just found myself getting more and more excited about the content and more excited about the mission. And then more and more excited about what I'd say the biggest differences with academia, which is being able to have a mission with a whole bunch of people. It's almost the opposite of the job of sitting alone in a room and writing a book that others might read. You're with other people, you're on a mission together, you're all working towards one thing. And I just fell in love with that environment and didn't want to leave.
And one of the things we've talked about is how much mentorship has mattered to you along the way. And in particular, if you could talk a little bit about how you were mentored along the way and coached in various ways, but you've also become someone who's like a key mentor for so many people And I've watched that evolution in the time that I've been at Bridgewater, where you've become the person that is a key touchstone for so many people at Bridgewater, men and women. Tell us about that, how you experienced it, and now why you, and how you pay it forward.
Well, I think that the culture that Bridgewater has always had of what I would really call mentoring, meaning taking the time and whoever's sitting in front of you, thinking really hard about why are they thinking what they're thinking, what mistakes are they making, how can they be better, and then giving you opportunities to try the next thing or do the next challenge. I don't think I ever would have learned what I did or come nearly as far as I did without that. From day one, I mean, for me, my closest mentors have really been our three chief investment officers, Ray Dalio, Bob Prince, Greg Jensen. And I think all three of them could not care less who you are, where you're from, what background you have. They 100% look at what they're hearing, what the person is saying, and want to make you better. And that can be harsh at times, because sometimes you get told that what you're thinking is really, really stupid and wrong. But it opened up a lot of opportunities a lot faster for me than otherwise, because there was never a sense of holding back and thinking, you know, let's not give this person this feedback because they might be offended, or looking at me and saying, you know, she's just a young girl out of school. She shouldn't know better. There was always a sense of let's give her all of the feedback that we really have and give her the opportunity to do it better, even if it was a much harder, more difficult thing. And I really feel like when I look back at all those years, all three of them in different ways often saw potential in me that I wouldn't have seen in myself. They were able to look at me and say, hey, I see the ability for you to do this thing next. Let me give you this challenge. At times where I thought whatever challenge they were giving me was crazy and wasn't something that I was really up to at the time. And, you know, kind of as my role grew, I think that one of our strengths in talking so openly about people's strengths and weaknesses is that creates an incredible flexibility of saying, you know, what's the right way to help this particular person. One of the stories, I was actually talking to someone in the audience earlier, and it just brought this memory back to me of when I first, a number of years ago, started doing any degree of speaking to clients. Whoever was running that kind of organized, you know, here's how we've usually talked to people about doing public speaking, realized that a lot of what I was struggling with was really different than what a lot of people before me did. Maybe partly because I'm a female, maybe not, but there were big differences. And the flexibility of saying, hey, why don't you speak to a different kind of coach, have a different kind of mentor, let's look at this from a different perspective versus kind of follow the cut rule. That openness of talking really just without worrying about what a particular strength and weakness is and what someone's struggling with has given us a lot of flexibility in helping people in different ways. And so as I've kind of tried to mentor people through the years, and there are some people in this audience that, but I look at them, it's been some of my most fun times at Bridgewater seeing them grow. I've tried to, one, focus most on the people that sometimes somebody else didn't see it in them, and maybe even argued, you know, we got to get rid of this person, they're not good, and saying, well, if I see something and a potential, they might not even see it in themselves, they might not be ready to advocate for themselves yet. If I see that potential, I want to help that person bring it about. And then, yeah, stay flexible and basically say what is the best way to both be really honest with the person about whatever problems they're having, but use that honesty as a way to give them challenges that might be bigger than what they expect. Because I do think sometimes we hold back because we think, well, that person's not going to do it anyway, versus actually giving them room to run. And really some of my best times at Bridgewater have been seeing people achieve potential that I kind of suspected they had, but maybe others didn't see or they didn't quite see in themselves. And a couple of years later, you see them, you know, being really world-class at a job in a way we've never seen before. And maybe, especially because we've never seen it before, we didn't know to look for it.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the thing you mentioned before, which is the harsh feedback. And the Bridgewater people in the audience know this is sort of part of the culture, which is a constancy of feedback, you know, accurate feedback, positive and negative. And that's a real important part of the development. And we all get it, myself included. So if I look back in my 10 years, you know, the big weakness I would have had or the big challenge was having equanimity and being able to listen to both sides of an argument and not jump to an opinion and sort of really digest it and try to understand. So not move too quickly and sort of maintain open-mindedness and balance. That's one of many things. But tell us about yours. Tell us about the things in your 13 years that you struggled the most with and where you are on that, you know, journey of evolving and learning from that?
Well, it's funny. I hear you talk about that weakness, and everyone here, I'm sure, is thinking Karen has that weakness on steroids. And the fact that everyone can laugh and say that's because we talk about it so openly. But I think the first, to me, the most impactful piece of feedback that I got that has stayed with me for so many years because it's so hard to do is probably the first project I ever did directly with Ray, our founder. You know, he used very harsh words at the time and telling me what I was doing was complete junk. But the main kind of gist of what he was saying was that I was really way too stuck in, I think, the mentality we mostly have to adopt when we're in university, which is you kind of got to latch on to whatever data is there, whatever's knowable, and put it together into a story. And that's what you got to do if you got to write a paper or a report, right? You got to deal with what's there and put it together in some reasonable way. And he basically said, you will never succeed if you're not first thinking, what do I need? What is not there? What is actually the thing that I don't know and must find a way to answer? And sometimes the thing that you must find a way to answer is really hard to answer. But by saying, that's the thing I really got to answer, you will find a way and you will cut through walls and whatnot. And you won't at least pretend you have an answer where it's just the best you had at that moment. And it's incredibly powerful advice that I think a person spends a lifetime trying to do, because it's not, we make a lot of shortcuts in life and we have to constantly just take the things we know and go with them. And so to me, it's a constant battle to say what is really important, and on those things, question all assumptions and remember that what you don't know is actually by far the most important thing. And it's easy to be fooled by the things that you already know and feel confident about. And that relates to the type of feedback you were given on, you know, overconfidence, easy to jump to answers, not worrying enough about what you don't know and what's not coming easy, I think is really the driver of that. And to me, it was both really valuable to hear and something that it's going to be, for me, I think, a lifetime thing. It's something where I'm always going to have to be paranoid and question my assumptions, and I'm sure I'm never going to do it well enough. But man, am I happy that I heard that. And having so many people around me that I trust, that have heard that we've talked about it, that we've been through it, actually makes it a lot easier for me now than, you know, 10 years ago, if I'm in a meeting, for someone to just say, hey, you know, you're saying this, Karen, but this is exactly where you can be weak. You're relying too much on what we've already learned, and maybe that's not the most important question to answer, and we got what we don't know. And I just look and say, I trust this person. We've talked about this. If they're seeing me do this, even into the moment, it feels like what I'm saying is so right. Mm-hmm. I could say, okay, we've actually talked about my weaknesses, and they're probably right, and I should pause and kind of reassess where I am. And that creates a very comfortable environment to actually grow and be comfortable saying, yep, that is what I'm weak at. I'm probably doing something wrong here. Pause, reflect, step back.
Mm-hmm. So let's apply it. So, you know, you are one of the, really, in asset management, you're one of the foremost thinkers about markets. And, you know, you've increasingly played a really important role, Bridgewater. Spend a minute, and this crowd isn't mostly focused on this, but just given who you are and your expertise, spend a minute telling us on the things in the current outlook of the global economy that we know and what we don't know. What are the things that are most on your mind as one of our senior leaders in the investment area?
Good question. I mean, if you look at where we are, it's been 10 years or so since the financial crisis. We come out of the financial crisis, we have 10 years where we're mostly employing monetary policy tools that haven't been what were the primary way that we ran the economy. We're printing money, interest rates aren't the tool, and so on. And now 10 years later, you know, the basic cyclical stuff, if you will, we know really well. We've lived through this lots of times. We know what it means when the unemployment rate is very, very low. We know what it means when you've had an expansion for some number of years. And that feels like a typical cycle because any investors live through them. And if you look through economic history, there have been many of them. But then there are the things that are very unique about this cycle and don't look like ones we've ever seen before and have a lot more unknowns. The most important one of them being what tools are actually going to be effective in this kind of environment. So we already have lived through 10 years where interest rates were not that effective. We kind of know that. But now, quantitative easing and printing money is also a lot less likely to be effective because we're 10 years out. And so we're potentially facing a next downturn where we genuinely don't really know what might be effective and how policymakers should go about that. And so the whole function of how do I respond to that sort of cyclical thing that feels really normal is very different given all those unknowns. And we're seeing a lot of experimentation, but every time the experimentation happens, there's more unknowns and knowns around that. So negative interest rates. If you polled investors, central bankers a couple years ago, they would have told you, you know, you can't have negative interest rates below, I don't know, negative 50 basis points at most, because people are just going to start storing money. We don't really know that. We've barely tried that. Switzerland is really pushing the limits on that. Maybe that's going to be more effective than we think. Maybe also the shift to things like a cashless society will make it really hard to physically store money. And so maybe there is actually a lot that interest rates can be lowered. We've never seen an expansion with as little inflation as we have. We have guesses why that is, but there's a hell of a lot of unknowns there. And then what I'd say is maybe the biggest unknown is that this environment where you've gone through such a long boom period where basically the forces of economics were able to push a lot more of the share of GDP into corporate profits, away from wages, to create an environment where inequality has grown as much as it has and so on. It's created a set of political tensions that we really don't know how they're going to play out. We have some guesses, but the guesses aren't good. You look at the 1930s, that's not a good set of outcomes. And so political tools that are responding to all these societal pressures are beginning to be more standardly applied to economic problems in ways they weren't. Tariffs really were not commonly applied to solve economic problems, let alone, you know, immigration problems or border problems like they have been suggested in places like Mexico. And so we have this whole big new menu that's being utilized in very different ways. And we're looking at a time where this cycle we're really familiar with might play out in very, very different ways. And that really speaks to a lot of what our research priorities have been, which is look at all these unknowns, study anywhere where we're getting any clues about what are different policies being used like in a place like China, which has always employed very, very different policy tools in the 1930s, and other cases of tension that is political, in cases where I've already seen a lot of political outcomes like Brexit, and try to learn as much as you can, knowing that there's still a lot more unknowns than knowns about how an environment that is in such a different place secularly might play out going forward.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask a couple more questions, and then we're going to open up the floor. So I'm going to give everybody time to think about their good questions, and we'll have plenty of time to ask them of Karen. Let me go back to Bridgewater for a minute. I just want to jump back and forth on a couple of different areas. And, you know, we've, together with the involvement and the leadership of others in the room, we've gone through a bit of a journey on how we talk about and how we think about diversity and inclusion. You've been an important part of that. Caitlin and many others in the room have been an important part of that. Can you talk about that through your eyes? In other words, how you've experienced it, how you think about that within the context of the idea of meritocracy and the talent that we're trying to attract, and, you know, where we are in that journey from your perspective and where we're headed.
Yeah, I think that we always had the right DNA, but we never quite acknowledged what was incumbent upon us as an organization. So I think we always had the right DNA, because from the day I joined, you wouldn't have seen diversity in any statement. There was no diversity, you know, task force or group the way we have today. But we really, really greatly believed that every type of thinking was encouraged, and we wanted to get people to kind of be their authentic selves at work. And that environment of open and honest, one of the things that really resonated with me, I remember starting to work at Bridgewater, was there was constantly conversation among my college friends about what you couldn't say at work and what you couldn't talk about at work and what you couldn't be at work. And it ranged from really small things like, I have a good friend from college that was kind of reprimanded for being unladylike for leaning on furniture, all the way to friends saying, I could never talk about my personal relationship at work, like, you know, I'm engaged, but that would be a horrible topic because that would create all of these biases about me and so on. And Bridgewater was never like that. There was always a sense that starting with that culture where you talk openly about weaknesses and strengths and everything, it always made it very, very open. And we always encouraged people to just say what was on their mind and be really open with things. And there was never a sense that you should hold back from kind of bringing your whole self with everything with you to work. And that environment of being really open and honest on feedback created an environment where it was very much okay to kind of say what you thought, and different opinions were very much respected. There was always a sense that we needed a team with different strengths and weaknesses, so we wanted a diversity of thought in that way. And I think the journey we've been through as an organization was realizing what the actual barriers were that were stopping us. That was basically had us pause and say, wait a minute, we believe in this whole diversity of thought, diversity of experience, but why are we not quite getting as many people as we'd like that are actually coming with that diversity of background and experience. And I think that led us to great soul searching that, you know, you, Dave, I think did tremendous leadership on, and that I don't think can really work if it's not led top down. And you as CEO with your co-CEO Eileen really said, this has got to be top down. This is an important company priority. We got to look top down ourselves and say, whatever the barriers are, we got to remove them. Whatever the barriers are that are making it more difficult for people that have any kind of diversity of experience or that don't feel comfortable fully bringing themselves to work, we got to go deal with that. And I think that started in kind of a classic Bridgewater, right? Uncovering lots of problems, because we encourage people, speak up, what's going on, what's standing in your way? And got out a lot more people saying, you know, in this situation, I felt less comfortable, I felt this, I felt that. And helped us, I think, be on a good journey, which of course we're not done. I think there'll be lots more to do, but hopefully put us on a good journey to create an environment that has as many people as possible feel, you know, comfortable to be themselves, feel that we're really encouraging diversity of thought and background and so on, and makes us more hopefully proactive if somebody sometimes doesn't even realize that's what they need and saying it. I mean, one of the examples I have of this is, I don't think I ever would have asked for this, and I don't. But I remember when one of the people who was a great mentor to me told me that he always plays a specific list of famous speeches for people and then talks about them. And when he did it with me, it suddenly occurred to him for the first time, all the speeches I play are speeches of men. I never realized that. Well, I don't think he ever played that role with me. Now, I don't think I would have ever spoken up about it, but the fact that he suddenly realized that and said, you know, I want to go do the research and find a great speech by a woman, I feel like that might be better training for you. That was one of the moments where I said, okay, we've done something that it wasn't incumbent upon me. Who knows if the woman's speech helped me more than the man's speech, but we've created enough of an environment where a lot of our senior leaders are proactively thinking, you know, is there anything I could be doing that would more help this person bring their best out, would more help them with their weaknesses, would really help them in whatever way I can? Because at the end of the day, the goal is to make those people better and mentor them better. That was one of the moments where I felt like we're doing a good job changing the culture in helping as much as possible people really ask that question proactively and say, how do we create an environment with as much inclusion as possible?
Did he come back with a good speech?
He did.
Who was the speech? Keep it, let us know. I'm thinking Margaret Thatcher. What is it?
I think he decided against Margaret Thatcher. There was some discussion of this. I think he basically did a roundup of a few tech leaders at the time, which was interesting. Uh-huh. Like he did, like, you know, a little Sheryl Sandberg, a little Marissa Meyer, a little Hillary Clinton thrown in there. But he was clearly trying to immerse himself and find what is one that will have the same kind of lessons that were like in his Obama speech. Right. And then a few months later, when Michelle Obama gave some really great speeches, I told him, you know, I think this is a better parallel to the Barack Obama speech you use. Something about the tone. I think you have some of the lessons aren't the same.
Yeah. Good. Well, that's impressive. So one of the things about bringing your authentic self to work that you and I just have talked about, but just talked about earlier tonight, was managing a relationship where both of the people in the relationship have high-powered careers and so forth. And I know you have some of that going on with Sam, and I'm certainly familiar with that phenomenon myself. And so the question is, how do you balance all that? How do you think about it? And you know, it's probably a journey in terms of wrestling with that, but give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I imagine you, Dave, like you said, have as much great insight on this as anyone. But, you know, so my husband and I met back when I was at Princeton. So we've really, in some sense, grown up together. So you meet in college, you know. And I think that it's really exciting to have a couple where both people have an awesome career. It's really exciting to, you know, go home and be able to share thoughts and not do the same thing, but both be really excited about what you're doing. And I think there was just always from early on an acceptance that we both really loved what we were doing and wanted space for that and wanted to be excited for that. And that neither one of us could imagine kind of, you know, not having a career we were excited about. And that was part of the relationship great, right? We could always talk about these things and so on. And I think the best advice I have, not that I think there's necessarily good advice that comes from any of this, is we try to be thoughtful about where does each person have flexibility, not have flexibility? Because when you have two different careers, they're often very different points that are, you know, kind of compromisable and not compromisable for the two different people. And each person flex on where there's flexibility and not. My husband runs a startup, so his literal space and time is more flexible than mine is, being kind of more in an office. But then other things, he can be less, a lot less flexible than I am. And what does that person really, really care about? And try to get both people to get as much as they can of the things they really care about. Because you can't both ask for everything. Everyone's going to have to give up something. But trying to be really respectful of what does the other person really care about, what is compromisable to them and not, what's going to work for their career and not. And enjoy the time together that you have and make the most of it. And remember that that is part of what makes the relationship great. It's not, it wouldn't be the same great relationship if you weren't both also loving what you're doing and having all this outside stimulation.
You know, it's probably easy for people, particularly people that are earlier in their career, to sit and look at you and, you know, sort of say, you've got it all figured out. You know, you've had a great, you know, you're on a great trajectory. You've had a phenomenal, 13 years and have done unbelievably well. Just let me finish with two questions that I hope you'll go into. One, what would be the advice you'd have for people in their, you know, in their careers as they're thinking about, you know, the next 10 years? And everybody in the room is at different stages, but what, drawing from your experience, what advice do you have? That's the first thing. And the second thing is maybe ask you to be a little bit vulnerable on what are you most worried about? Because, you know, my experience has been when people look at you up here and they think you've figured it all out, you're thinking to yourself, I haven't figured it all out. And there's a million things that are you're probably concerned about and worried about. Can you talk about both of those things?
Sure. On the advice, I think my biggest advice will be, it's cliche in some ways, but you need to ask questions even when you think they're stupid questions and put yourself out there. Because I think that it's very, very hard to learn if you're in your own head and scared of asking questions. And I've seen this with very, very talented people, that they come in and they don't want to sound stupid. And they feel like doing well is this big part of their vision for themselves. And so they couldn't bear people to think they're not amazing at what they're doing because you've dreamed your whole life of getting to where you are. And that means you hold back and you don't want to sound stupid in any situation. And you think, when I really, really know what's going on, I'll ask a question. But then the opposite can happen, which is you find yourself a few months later and now you can't ask that question anymore because now it's a really stupid question. Like, where have you been these last few months? How did you not figure this out yet? So it could kind of snowball to the point where, like, your level of knowledge actually gets where behind where it needs to be and you're not actually kind of growing and learning. It becomes a lot less fun for you and you're a lot less likely to keep being successful. And it's a lot better to put yourself out there and put yourself at risk early on and just ask what you don't understand and say what you're wrestling with. Even if in the moment some people do think that you sound stupid and do kind of look at you funny, the payoff through time is much higher because your learning just becomes a lot better through that process. And I find that when people come to me for advice thinking that their jobs aren't working for them, the most common thing I see is just that the person's become disengaged with the job in some way. They've kind of given up on that or themselves. And that often comes back to earlier on, I didn't want to put myself out there. I didn't want to sound stupid and so on. And so I think that's really important. And if you're, you know, at work and can't get engaged with anything, you're probably not that passionate about it. And if you are passionate about it, you probably will have questions and, you know, kind of want to engage and that sort of thing. The other one I usually tell people early in their career is always look above yourself and make sure you understand the context and everything around you. Because sometimes people make it sound like magic of, you know, this person was really good because they were able to connect the dots or see the next thing or come up with the next idea. But it's not really magic if you take the literal assignment you're given and just put your head down and do it and don't even understand, like, what is that assignment going towards and what does that connect to? It'll make it very hard for you to suddenly have the magic idea that is above what you're doing. You have to have some ability to actually know what the context is of everything to be able to make connections or see a different direction the business might be going or a different way of doing things. And that also can be hard if you're really in kind of early on trying to prove yourself. You want to just put your head down and do the thing you're asked to do. And then the things I'm worried about, I mean, let me put it like this. The gist of it is very simple, which is our job, while really exciting, is also impossibly hard because we are literally taking active views in every part of the world, in every market, trying to predict what's going to happen. And there are always going to be way more unknowns than knowns. And there isn't a day I don't get up and look in the mirror and say, I'm not really capable of having this job, right? Like, this seems way harder than what I could possibly do. Like, it's not like there's no way that I possibly know the answers to these things, and people are going to come to me and want me to make decisions on things or feel comfortable with positions we have on the markets. And there's always going to be a million more things that I don't actually know. And that's a tough thing to balance, because that's the reality, you know, but that's the reality.
But how do you, when you look in the mirror and see you're not up to it, but then somehow you come to work and do it, what's the process you go through to get from that person to the person that seems to be on top of things and have the answers?
I don't know. I think there's
some sort of power shake or something we can offer. There's got to be something.
I don't know. It's a hard question to answer. I feel like part of it is that I think there's probably a healthy part there, that if you're ever not looking at yourself in the mirror and thinking, I could definitely do this, you're way overconfident.
Yeah, sell.
Like, you're way overconfident. Like, sell, get out of that fund. You don't want a money manager that's definitely sure of their positions. They should not be. And realizing that's part of the deal, and that success in money management still means making lots of mistakes. You know, for us, a great, great year might be that like 60% of our views were right or something. So that's a lot of mistakes that we're making all the time, and that I wouldn't be good at this if I wasn't really, you know, stressed out about those and worried about making them. And then I think the other piece, honestly, is I really love what I'm doing. And so at some level, there's the concern about, oh my God, I can't really do this job. But then on the other hand, go in, you love it, you enjoy what you're doing, you want to immerse yourself. And then I think the third thing is, I think the team really helps. I think that I fell in love with doing this with a team for a reason, which is, you know, when I look at the model of either writing a book on your own or even being a PM on your own completely without a team, I think, wow, that's a lot more lonely. And we have something really incredible, which is that incredible burden that I'm carrying. I feel like there's a lot of people who shoulder it with me. I'm looking around some of them, you know, and they also are coming in every day worried, not sure what we're doing is right, asking questions, and we're kind of in it together trying to get the right answer. More eyes looking for problems is sure better than just mine.
That's great. I think that's a good point to end this part of the conversation on. Thank you.